Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, Mitt Romney's scheduled meeting with Donald Trump, LGBTQ Utahns work to unify in the wake of the election, Senator Orrin Hatch ponders running for an eighth term, additional funding is needed to keep education spending at its current per pupil level, plans to drill for oil near to Bears Ears, a legislative audit looking at the U of U's athletics programs, and more. Joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley is with us. Good morning, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner is here as well. Welcome, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thank you.
Government reporter Robert Gurkio is in studio. Good morning to you, Robert.
Hey, good morning.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. via the phone is Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Tommy, welcome and good morning to you as well.
Hey, good morning, Roger. Thanks.
And listeners, you were invited to join this discussion with your questions and comments. Call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. I'm going to welcome one more person, sports reporter Kyle Goon, who is joining us in studio. Thanks for being here, Kyle.
Thank you.
Thomas Burr, I'm going to kick things off today with you. Yesterday, we learned that Mitt Romney, the former GOP presidential nominee and a longtime vocal critic of Donald Trump, now has plans to meet with the president-elect and maybe even talk about a cabinet posting. Tommy, we've heard so much in recent news about fake news stories, but this is the real thing.
This is definitely the real thing. In fact, I just got off a call with the transition team for president-elect Donald Trump. Where they were asked about, why is he meeting with Mitt Romney? Didn't Mitt Romney, criticize him pretty strongly? In fact, if you remember, he called him a phony and a fraud in March, trying to halt his momentum. And the response from the transition team was that Trump wants the best and brightest people to put the country forward, people who supported him, people who didn't support him. He just wants to have conversations with the people like Mitt Romney. They obviously gave no indication of whether he's going to be offered any cabinet spot. But it is interesting, the people he has already nominated and whom he's meeting with, and we're seeing various different sides. He sits down with Henry Kissinger, but he also just appointed Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General and General Flynn, right. Michael Flynn, as a National Security Advisor. The team so far is very much loyalists, and Romney was definitely not a loyalist.
Well, and that's an interesting point. I mean, back in March, Romney led the sort of GOP establishment revolt against Trump, and at one point he even talked about what he called trickle-down racism coming from the White House if Trump were to be to get that to be elected. If Romney is offered a cabinet position, is that Trump trying to make amends with the GOP mainstream, or does he even need to do that at this point?
It's interesting. We'll see, I guess, what actions he takes there. But it could be a couple things. One, it could be Romney saying, maybe it's best if I'm on the inside to try to shape this administration and take it the right direction and show his wise sage kind of advice to the incoming president. For Trump, it's trying to get together people who have the experience and can do these things, who will have the respect of the establishment, maybe, to get some stuff done.
Another aspect of this is that for a time, in fact, for most of the campaign, Trump was seen as having a vulnerability when it came to Mormon voters because of, his life story, his statements against Muslims and immigrants, and his disparaging comments about women that were captured on that leaked video. In the end, though, that idea that he had a vulnerability with Mormons didn't really hold, as he ended up getting a good deal of Mormon support. Mitt Romney embodied the supposed Mormon rejection of Trump. And Tommy, I don't know, does Romney now embody the ultimate coming home of Mormon voters, of the GOP? It depends upon what happens.
Well, let's just start. They're just meeting, so we don't know yet if anything's being offered, if he's offered Secretary of State, something like that. But they're meeting, and it is, it's probably incumbent on people like Mitt Romney to sit down with the incoming president and offer their advice. It would be unwise to have people just say, nope, I didn't support him, I'm not going to help him. Maybe it's coming home for all of America to try to say, okay, this is where we're at right now, and let's make the best of it we possibly can make.
And some rumors out there that he's being considered for Secretary of State.
Yeah, we've heard that. If you recall, this is the interesting part. Romney was talking about how Russia was our number one geopolitical foe when he ran for office in 2012. Obama kind of poo-pooed that. And now we're in a situation where the president-elect has said many great things about Vladimir Putin and Russia. They don't necessarily agree on all foreign policy, so I'm not sure if that's the position they'll offer or if anything, but okay, that's the rumor.
On a related note, Tommy, you wrote this week about concerns expressed by Trump's appointment of Steve Bannon as his chief strategist. Some of those concerns had to do with comments that Bannon had made about Mormons or comments that he had given voice to as the editor of the far-right website, Breitbart.com. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there certainly are some concerns. Steve Bannon is now going to be essentially the presidential whisperer. He's going to be the guy closest to the incoming president in his administration. And his views have been criticized a lot because he's supposedly tight with the alt-right community, who some would say just, you know, stop using euphemism and call them white nationalists or white supremacists. The news site Breitbart has, you know, published several things that are very critical of the establishment and lean towards almost supporting that alt-right movement. Bannon himself even questioned Mitt Romney's son's military service, saying, you know, none of them served a day in the military, but they definitely served their Mormon missions. Just going to point out real fast that none of Donald Trump's children either did any military service.
Right. I want to send out a quick reminder to our listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments. Call us at 801-355-8255. Some other strong statements about Bannon after his appointment. Spokesman for retiring Nevada Senator Harry Reid said that it was a signal that the white supremacists will be represented at the highest levels in Trump's White House. And Republican political consultant John Weaver, who's an advisor to John Kasich, Ohio governor, called Bannon a racist anti-Semite and said that America should be, quote, vigilant. Given those kinds of criticisms, Tommy, and the statements about Mormons, is there room, I mean, just going back to Romney, is there room in a Trump White House that's essentially being led by Bannon for somebody like Romney in the end?
You know, we just don't know. I think, Bannon, the chief of staff is going to be the current Republican National Committee chairman, but it's already been said pretty much he's going to be the logistics guy. He's going to run the White House, whereas Bannon is the chief strategist to kind of lead out on all the policy and ideas that are going to come from the White House. Whether Mitt Romney can get along with Bannon, I don't think we know yet. Okay. Who else he appoints to other positions will also tell whether what direction Mr. Trump is going to take this White House.
In your article, you reported that the Southern Poverty Law Center has been tracking reports of This is actually in Jennifer Doudna's article, and I'll get to that in a minute. but along those lines, the appointment of people like Bannon, and this is how we'll get to Jennifer Doudna, is that that's not something that's reassuring to people who are already fearful of a Trump presidency. And among those is a group that you wrote about, Jennifer, Utah's LGBTQ community, in response to the election, expressing some fears, expressing a desire to come together to kind of unify in the wake of the election, a fear that even motivated a wedding, apparently.
Yes, a couple from Salt Lake City who got married in a hurry the day after the election. One of them had worked quite vigorously on that Clinton campaign. There's no question that there's been an advancement of gay rights and equality through the Obama administration. Marriage, transgender bathrooms, any number of things that have made life better and arguably easier for members of the gay and trans community. They have some fear that they won't be able to hang on to those.
And partially in response to the election outcome, Utah Pride Center, you report, launched a "We See You and We Love You" campaign.
Yeah.
as a way to kind of assuage those fears.
They're distributing for free these rainbow colored bracelets that say "We see you and we love you." They want to give them to people who are either members of the LGBT community or allies, so that people can see a visible sign of support when they're out in the community. I got a text yesterday that after this story came out, they have had, I will tell you, like response from all over the country, and they are going to run out of their bracelets already because they've had such a positive response. So let me see. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, like 15 states and a military base in Scotland and Sweden where they've had people contact them saying, we want to participate. We want to be a visible sign of support and safety.
Responding to the We See You and We Love You campaign. An interesting part of your story is that you talked about the fear of those legal processes being undone, disrupted, maybe adoption or transgender people seeking passports.
So some people... Some conservatives have argued that the Obergefell Supreme Court decision that legalized marriage for the country was incredibly narrow and that it didn't automatically confer rights like adoption or other things on gay couples. And so there's been some – there's a Rainbow Legal Clinic here in Utah for the gay community. They've been advising gay couples to do their second parent adoptions for the non-biological parent if they haven't done it already to get their passport. There's a administrative rule presently that if you're a transgender person you can get a new passport with the gender that you identify with and that you're using, even if it's not your gender that it was assigned to you at birth. And so that's something that could be undone with a signature. And they are concerned that if you don't get those things in place now, that you those things may go away.
That's a question that I have: is how likely is it for those things to go away? Say, getting the passport, or for adoption, the adoption. Being able to have a second parent adoption.
Well, I think some of those things will take a lawsuit. Marriage, for example, will take two appointments to the Supreme Court and a new lawsuit.
Right.
So some people feel like marriage is maybe be safe. Other things are more policy decisions. Transgender bathrooms. Obama signed an order earlier this year. I think Trump could probably undo that with a signature. Like many things, it remains to be seen where our president-elect is going to go and how, what kind of conservative turn things are going to take.
You also wrote, you interviewed a Salt Lake City attorney who I think maybe works with the Pride Center, who said that he was worried that the Utah State Legislature would read the election as a mandate against political correctness and a mandate against the advancement of social issues.
Well, we have a very conservative legislature. That's a group that has, for example, failed to pass a hate crimes legislation that offers protections for LGBT individuals for I don't even know how many years I've been covering that story, more than 10. I think Chris Wharton's position is that it's possible that conservatives in Utah and everywhere will see this as the permission slip to stop making what they probably feel are concessions.
You reported, and it was you who reported that the Southern Poverty Law Center has been looking at reports of harassment against Muslims, immigrants, African-Americans, LGBTQ citizens around the country, and that they've documented a number of those incidents.
Yeah, I think as of Monday of this week, that number was 300. I think I saw something yesterday that said it was now over 400. So, and I talked to the ACLU here in town, and they said that they have had a number of complaints and that they will be monitoring this. The ACLU nationally is also taking they are collecting data and gathering information, and I assume would take action if they felt that it was warranted.
Maybe I don't know, trickle-down racism. I don't know. That's Mitt Romney's statement there. But from months back, I guess, and you said that Utah hasn't escaped this. ACLU is tracking it. You reported on one incident in particular in Ogden, I think.
There's a couple in Ogden, a gay couple in Ogden, who woke up to some gay slurs on their cars. I have not been able to speak with them directly, but they were quite rattled. I've heard through, secondhand that they've experienced some death threats. And so, I think those things are, they're not part of my experience walking in the world, but they are real for other people. And we'll be keeping an eye on things.
Okay. Jennifer Dobner reporting. Great reporting there, and available at sltrib.com. Of course, listeners, we are going to have to take a very short break, but you can call us to join this discussion with your comments, your questions. The number is 801-355-TALK. Keep it tuned right here. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune reporter news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jennifer Dobner, Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, Kyle Goon, and Thomas Burr. Again, you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or by calling us at 801-355-TALK. I want to kind of close out the national politics section of the show here, but we can't do that before we address Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, who is reportedly mulling over running for re-election, running for an eighth term. Tommy, what's the latest there?
So I think we all remember that in 2012, when Senator Hatch was running for a seventh term, he pretty much said, you know, this is my last run. This is my last time. I'm going to be asking you to vote for me. He since walked that back and said that he may run for an eighth term if he can maybe get some tax reform done. He's now saying, and he told reporters here in Washington this week, that he's considering a run, and a lot of people are urging him to stay in an office to run for an eighth term because they feel like his position as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee really gives him a lot of ability to get something done on the tax code, on pushing through a conservative agenda, and he's not saying yes or no. But also interesting now is Evan McMullen. All recall, I think Gerke called him the guy that ran for president of Utah. he ran as an independent presidential candidate, is now considering running for the Senate as well in 2018. That would put up, you know, Hatch against McMullen. Other names that have been floated include John Huntsman Jr., who, when I asked him, didn't respond to that, just praised Hatch and said Hatch was a great guy. So that kind of leaves open the possibility there, too.
Robert Gerke, would or Tommy, either of you, but would McMullen run if he were to run for Senate as a Republican?
I think he probably would. I mean, it's hard to run as an independent. Much easier to get on the ballot and get the following if you're a Republican. But as Tommy mentioned, there's a number of people who are lining up who are interested in this spot. I've heard Boyd Matheson's name, Derek Miller's name, who is Gary Herbert's former chief of staff. There are people who are interested in this. The Romney name always gets dropped in there, Josh Romney. I've heard Mike Leavitt's name. So there's a lot of people who are already, there's this big bottleneck that's been created by somebody who's been, you know, in that office for 49 years, and Jason Chaffetz, his name, gets thrown in there too, and all of these people want to run, and now Orrin Hatch is sort of, you know, doing this thing where he said, well, I said that, but, you know, it's sort of like there's a line in Animal House, you screwed up, Flounder, you trusted us. I don't think anybody actually believed that Orrin was going to step aside, though. I mean, this has sort of been a repeating occurrence. Like, he is too important to the state and too important to the country to actually give up this position. And so, you know, if you thought he wasn't going to run for an eighth term, I think maybe you were fooling yourself.
Well, from those people...
Can I just ask, is that the first time that Senator Orrin Hatch's name's been dropped with
Animal House.
The same sentence?
It's got to be true. Tommy, has there been a response from those people who are, you know, Robert Gerke says there's a bottleneck of candidates. Has there been a response from any of them about Hatch's considering, you know, running for an eighth term?
You know, I think they're all thinking, you know, they're not going to criticize Hatch necessarily, but they are going to talk about, you know, their own time. Everyone brings up he's been in office for 40 years. When we all know when Hatch ran for office, originally he said that Frank Moss had been in the Senate 18 years and that was too long.
Right.
And this bottleneck is happening because they're all saying, you know, it's time. You've served, give other people a chance. And kind of the response as well is saying, okay, yes, you're powerful because you've been there so long. But how is somebody else going to ever get seniority if you stay in office forever?
The joke that Hatch made when he was running was, what do you call an 18-year senator? You call him home. I think, you know, you could turn that around on Hatch. What do you call a 7-term senator? You call him an ambulance, I think.
Oh, wow. Jokes being told on Behind the Headlines here. Listener,
I'll be here all day.
Listeners, call us up and give us your jokes as well. Now, we want to hear your thoughts on the stories we're covering. The number to call again, 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com. I guess we will see who ends up in that contest. Is there a chance that somebody might run even if Hatch is running? I mean, try and challenge him in a primary battle.
I would say it's likely. I mean, he got a challenger 6 years ago in Dan Lillenquist. Again, he Lindquist forced him to a primary, but Hatch trounced him in a primary. I think with the signature gathering route on the ballot, it's likely that he'll get one or probably multiple challengers this year.
Okay. Again, all of the Tribune's political coverage can be found at sltrib.com. Listeners, check it out there. We need to turn to other stories, though. So, Tommy Burr, I'm gonna let you go. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you, but
yes,
thanks for joining us today
on
Behind the Headlines.
I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Let's shake things up here and turn to public lands. Brian Maffley, you had a couple of stories related to the proposed Bears Ears National Monument that came out this week. One of them was about plans that an energy company has to drill for oil in the region. Who is this company, and what are they proposing?
Yeah, Roger. The country at issue is EOG Resources, who has not been very active in San Juan County in the last few decades, but they are extremely active in the Uinta Basin. And their proposed drill sites are both on state trust lands and on BLM lands, right on the eastern fringe of the proposed Bears Ears Monument, and also right outside the town of Bluff, where a lot of folks would prefer not having oil and gas development right outside of town.
And as you said, the company already has this this contract in the region with CITLA, the School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, and that has been already has been perturbing to conservationists in the area, right?
Yeah. Well, to back up just a little bit, the School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, which we call CITLA, controls, I don't know, 100,000 plus acres inside the Bears Ears proposed monument, right, which may or may not get designated, by the way, in the waning weeks of the Obama administration. Regardless, it's a pretty special landscape, whether or not it's a monument. And CITLA has a radically different mandate than the Bureau of Land Management for managing these lands. CITLA does what this legislature gave it a mandate to go forth and make money, which is pretty much opposite BLM, which is manages for multiple use, and occasionally that means conservation or wildlife or oil and gas. And and there's a public process and everything. CITLA doesn't have to go through a public process. And over the years, they have amassed this big block of land just outside of Bluff on what's called the Bluff Bench. It's very visible, and people have drilled there many times in the past and kind of came up, you know, snake eyes. So
do we know the likelihood of this company finding oil there now? Do they have new information?
There must be. They must have something that they're privy to. But what was interesting about this was when they acquired these leases from another company known as Morning Gun, they came with some contractual obligations to CITLA to drill test wells by a certain day. BLM would never have such a requirement on their leases, but CITLA does, because when they sell a lease to an oil company, they want it to produce oil, and if they don't do it by a certain time frame, they want the lease back.
And there's a certain amount of money they're supposed to spend as well in the process, $500,000?
That's correct. Yeah, it's a really strange contract. They're required to spend so much money first doing seismic testing, which has been done. That was by the earlier energy company.
Right.
But then to spend $500,000 by a certain date on the first test well, and then, of course, there's other test wells that are required to drill. And if they don't spend that much, then they need to pay what they didn't spend to CITLA.
I want to get to the National Monument designation aspect of this. And first off, I guess the first question I have is, if there is a monument designation, would that preclude or exclude this particular project from going forward?
No, it actually wouldn't, because under the Antiquities Act, when a monument gets designated, valid and pre-existing rights are honored. So that means any BLM oil and gas leases on Cedar Mesa would still be valid, although they'd be extremely difficult to develop. And all the grazing allotments would still be honored.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you also wrote this week, Brian Maffley, about concern from some quarters that if President Obama were to designate the Bears Ears National Monument, something that I don't, you know, he's only got a certain amount of time to do, but I'm wondering actually if it's more likely now given the outcome of the election. But anyways, that upon entering office, Trump might want to try and undo that designation. Is that something that's possible?
Oh, I think that's an exciting possibility. Mm-hmm. And I say that because no president has done that before, where they came in and undid an Antiquities Act designation by their successor. So it came up when George W. Bush was elected in 2000 and became president. This was 4 years after the Grand Staircase had been designated in a surprise designation by Bill Clinton that is resented to this day by many people in Utah. And they explored this question. The Congressional Research Service has explored this question. Can a incoming president undo a monument? And the conclusion was, no, not really. They can a new president can adjust a monument designation, but a designation by a president under Antiquities Act amounts to an act of Congress. So basically, it should be Congress to undo it. So if a Bears Ears gets designated, there will definitely be a congressional and possibly a legal challenge to the monument.
And is that something that we could see happening? I mean, that Congress challenging it and then actually succeeding at that challenge?
Well, again, that's within their legal authority to do so.
Okay.
And we've seen it through history. It's happened a few times. And Jason Chaffetz, which his district includes the Bears Ears, has basically vowed to challenge it in congression, through congressional action. And San Juan County is already exploring its legal options to file a lawsuit.
Okay. You know, you wrote about it being impossible to talk about the potential designation without also talking about the Utah Public Lands Initiative being pushed currently by Representatives Chaffetz and Bishop, Representative Bishop in particular. Is there any new calculus about that proposal given the election, the outcome of the election?
It's so complicated because if a monument doesn't get designated and Trump becomes president, and it's presumed that he would never consider such a designation, what the incentives to push the Public Lands Initiative or PLI through kind of go away, because a big motivating factor for that, for Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz's ambitious effort there, was to prevent President Obama from designating a monument in our state. And, you know, there's been a few candidates out there. The Bears Ears is the strongest, but there's also Greater Canyonlands and also San Rafael Swell. All three are pretty worthy landscapes of protection. So with Obama out of the White House, there's no possibility of a monument being designated.
Right. And so maybe there wouldn't be a need for it from the perspective of those who are pushing for those. Just before we get to our next break on the topic of public lands, who are the contenders right now for Interior Secretary, the person who oversees BLM and related lands?
It's so speculative. I see they're all over the map. And Sarah Palin's name gets thrown around a lot. And that, I don't know how serious that is. And that came out when she very conspicuously endorsed Trump's candidacy. But there are other probably more qualified people. And Cynthia Lummis, former or outgoing congresswoman representing Wyoming, she seems like a viable person. There's been talk of an energy company executive. Sometimes other names get tossed about, but I don't know how serious that is. So to me, it's very speculative. Maybe Robert has another.
I think Rob Bishop's name has been dropped in there as well. He's the chairman of the House Resources Committee, and that that would be something where he's got a background in it, and his name's been mentioned as a potential candidate.
And then he would have to leave. He would have to obviously step down from Congress, and his seat would be filled. Well, it's a fascinating world we're living in right now. Listeners, join us with your conversations, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Yes. Right now. Brian.
I was just going to add something, Roger. During the campaign, Donald Trump really never signaled strongly his feelings about public lands management. I think it's not even on his radar. So how he makes a decision about Interior or monument designations or I think it'll be set by the people he surrounds himself with.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I didn't ask Tommy this before he left, but I'm kind of wondering about the amount. Is it common to see very many retentions between administrations on opposite sides of the political aisle in cabinet posts? I mean, do we see people being retained very often through that time period? Maybe Robert Gerke, I don't know if you can address that.
I'm sorry.
You missed the question. Well, I'm wondering if there's, you know, we're talking about all of these new seats being, or cabinet positions being filled. Is it common to see retentions of cabinet members?
Okay. No, usually to the victor go the spoils. They've got people who've supported them and campaigned for them in the course of the election. And so there are people who want. Now, you will see sometimes if one Republican administration hands off to another Republican administration or vice versa, that they'll keep some people around. But
not between sort of opposing sides. We've got to take another quick break. But when we come back, we'll be talking about more stories from this past week, state education spending, as well as the findings of an audit of the University of Utah's athletics programs. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Jennifer Dobner, Kyle Goon, and Robert Gerke. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke and Kyle Goon, we still haven't touched on the stories you two have written this week. Robert, let's begin with a story about education spending, education funding in Utah. We're always hearing that Utah is the worst in per pupil spending in the United States. But to even maintain the level we're at now, the state is going to need to find some additional money. Why is that?
Well, because the population of the state is growing, and that includes the number of children who are going to be going to schools starting in the fall. The legislative analysts are projecting about 10,089 new students. Each year it grows by about 10,000 students. And so that means to maintain, even as you mentioned, the last in the nation level of funding, you've got to come up with about $115 million a year just to kind of keep your head above water.
Unexpected growth or just growth?
No, I mean, it's like I said, it's been growing pretty steadily at about 10,000 per year. The rate of growth is actually decreasing, but because the population's growing, you're still seeing about 10,000 new students every year, which, to put it in perspective, that means over 7 years you've added basically an Alpine school district, which is the largest in the state. And so it's significant. I mean, not only do you have to pay teachers for these students, you also have to build buildings, you have to, accommodate buses and things like that. This is so it's a
how much money are we talking about again?
About $115 million, which they're fortunately for legislators, they've got some money that comes into the education fund from income tax growth, and so there's going to be some money there that they can spend. But in terms of like trying to catch up with other states, and raise up this level, it makes it very hard when you're just barely treading water. The governor has said repeatedly and during the campaign season that education, when his budget comes out next month, education will be one of his top priorities. And so we'll see what he comes up with in that regard. But there's also but it's not just education that's going to be a demand on the budget this year. And so they've got to try to balance that out, too. I mean, they're going to have demands from, the colleges and universities. They're going to have requests for expanded Medicaid coverage and things like that. And so the money is going to be scarce, and trying to, plug that hole and make sure that the students education doesn't suffer is going to be tricky. When it's adjusted for inflation, actually, over the last 4 years, over the four most recent years available, I guess, the amount that the state has spent on education has actually decreased, in part because you've added about 45,000 new students over that period of time.
The number itself has gone up, but adjusted
Correct.
For inflation,
yeah.
It has increased. Yeah. It has decreased. You mentioned that there was an error in projecting how many students we'd see in this past year. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, they were pretty close. I think they were off by about 900 students. Oh. And so it's not a lot. But between that and some other things, they're going to have to come up with about $15 million just to sort of plug a hole that they underestimated a little bit. But their estimates, when you're dealing with, sort of fudgy variables like population growth and how many students are going to go to private school versus public school, because these numbers don't include those students in public school, in private school. Yeah. So to come in that close is pretty impressive. And one other interesting thing about these numbers is that they said about 2/3 of that growth is going to be going to charter schools versus the traditional, the traditional public schools.
So this will be factored into the governor's budget decisions. Also, I guess at the legislative session, there'll be discussions about it.
He'll bring his budget out next month, and again, we expect him to make a significant investment in education. And so, after he proposes his budget, typically the legislature disregards it and then does what they want to do anyway.
Okay, well, keeping our heads above water here. As long as we're talking about the legislative session or about the legislature, Kyle Goon, you have been patiently waiting here in the studio this entire hour, and thank you again for being here. The state legislature conducted an audit of the University of Utah's athletics program. Before we get to the findings of that audit, why was it initiated? Why was the audit begun?
I'm sorry, I missed it. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's a pretty sore spot for a lot of University of Utah fans. Back in January, Larry Krystkowiak, the head basketball coach at the University of Utah, announced he was going to cancel the remaining game of a series with BYU, right, which had been played for 100 years, basically without interruption. I think the last interruption was World War II. So, people were pretty fired up about it.
And just for some context there, the reason for that cancellation that he gave was because of some, I guess...
One of the BYU players in the game took a swing at a Utah player. And basically, there had been some incidents in the minds of the Utah coaching staff that they felt like it posed a danger to their players. I think, maybe another sort of issue there was... Utah has kind of backed out of some in-state series in the last couple years. They don't play Utah State anymore. They did announce recently a new tournament that's going to pit them against more in-state opponents, but they had been backing out of in-state series. Mm-hmm. And I think, perhaps one other way to read what was happening was, they're looking at, hey, we're in the Pac-12. BYU's in the West Coast Conference, which is a lesser conference, less prestigious. Maybe we can make them come back to the bargaining table and dictate more on our terms what we want. So, that's reading a lot into it.
Sure, but there was some speculation, though, that this audit was launched kind of in retribution to the cancellation of that game. Is that the idea?
Yes, and that has to do with right after the series cancellation, there were a lot of legislative officials who were, including Greg Hughes, who's on the audit subcommittee, saying, hey, this is ridiculous. This is, something that I'm not sure the University of Utah should be spending money. There was a lot of attention paid to an $80,000 buyout of the game and wondering where that money was coming from. Larry Krystkowiak said he was paying for himself. Then in February, Greg Hughes ordered an audit to go forward very quietly at the end of a meeting. And it kind of turn the U upside down and shake and see what shaked out.
The audit came out, I guess, this last week. What was it, a scathing audit? What was uncovered?
Yeah, I mean, it's there are not any smoking guns in the words of the athletic director and the auditors themselves. There wasn't a huge issue where you're like, oh wow, this is a terrible use of money. In fact, in some cases, they found that Utah is spending very reasonably compared to its Pac-12 peers. But you did see some recommendations, including, hey, you guys have to get a better handle on travel and equipment spending. You have to get a better handle on your hiring practices, and you have to get a better handle on your inventory, making sure you're tracking keys to the Huntsman Center. Apparently, there are 103 keys missing to the Huntsman Center. So if you have one, call into the show. What was the number again to call into the
355-TALK, show? 355-TALK.
So there were definitely things that stood out, but nothing that we would say, heads need to roll. And in many ways, kind of strengthened sort of the reputation of the department as a responsible spender in the Pac-12 and college athletics in general.
How about, I mean, now there was a close look given to the cancellation of that contract and how it was paid for that one game. What came out of that?
Yeah, so that is a little sketchy for sure. They found that the check for, so Larry Kraskowiak is going to be paying this $80,000 buyout supposedly out of pocket for the next 4 years in $20,000 installments. But the first check that they saw came from his foundation called the Crisco Foundation. If you're an auditor, you're wondering, wait, where is this money yours or is it from donors to your foundation or where is this money coming from? So they didn't have the actual power to look at bank statements and look at the foundation closely. But the administration talked to Larry Kraskowiak and was they assured the auditors that it came out of his pocket. He was it was his funds, right, that went to his foundation that paid for that installment. So and I think from here on out, you're probably not going to see any more checks from the Crisco Foundation. I think it's just a little bit too fuzzy.
It'll be more direct.
Yeah.
And so the University of Utah has agreed to make some changes as a result of this audit. Is that right?
Yeah.
Within that department.
Yeah. And Chris Hill was at the hearing on Tuesday and kind of said, you know, hey, we are a public institution. We're a public agency. This is kind of, and I mean, it's a good point. I mean,
he's the head of University of Utah Athletics.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yes, he's the athletic director. I'm sorry. And you know, I mean, it's a public entity, and it deserves scrutiny, and it deserves occasional audits. And they do have audits by the state, but certainly not to this level. I mean, auditors were literally housed in the football stadium and going through all their finances and going through their inventory and hiring records and not quite to this level of scrutiny. But I think what the department has taken out of it, you know, since there is no sort of skeletons in the closet that are threatening, you know, the department's existence, I think they're taking it as, hey, here's what we can do. Here's how we can be a better overall department.
Well, and the other outcome, I think, of this whole thing, this whole episode, has been this tournament that's coming up next week, which is also sort of the brainchild of Greg Hughes. He had a big hand in putting that together.
Yeah, and so there is going to be a tournament called the Beehive Classic, and I think, you know, it was announced over the summer, but I think as Robert's alluding to, there were more powers than maybe have been recognized involved in making that series.
And this is the resumption of the BYU-Utah, I guess, rivalry game. Is that right?
Kind of. They're going to be playing one another. Well, they actually will be playing one another every year, but it will sort of kick back in 2017. And okay, if you want to know how Larry feels about that, he's declined comment. So, yeah.
I was going to jump in. This is Brian Maffley. You know, I used to cover higher ed before I covered public lands, and these hard-hitting legislative audits are nothing new involving the University of Utah. It seemed like when I covered higher ed, every year there was a big audit directed at the university. And I think you get a lot of political mileage taking on this bastion of higher learning, so in that, you know, I thought that's important context. They love going after the U,
making certain that they're shining a light there as well as other places. Guys, I'm going to have you hold that thought because we are running really low on time, and I'd like to get to just one additional story before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And Jennifer Doebner, this story has to do with the confirmation of a judge, former Utah Heber representative Craig Powell, who faced a kind of difficult, a fraught confirmation hearing or confirmation as judge because of some statements he had made about gay people, I guess. Is that
correct? It started out fraught and it ended up okay for him. Representative Powell, who's from Heber City, as you said, is an attorney in his professional life. He last legislative session back in earlier this year had proposed a couple of bills that the gay and transgender community saw as anti-gay. One would have inserted the made-up word "parage" instead of marriage as a reference to same-sex unions. The other proposed compelling the state to give preferential treatment to heterosexual couples over homosexual couples in adoption. That portion of his bill actually came out before the legislation was introduced after some constitutional concerns were raised. He was nominated for a judgeship for the 4th District, a vacancy in the 4th District Court, which is based in Provo. And Equality Utah, a week ago, launched basically a letter-writing campaign to say, look, we don't know that our community can stand before him in family court matters and be treated equally. But at the confirmation hearing on Monday with the Senate Judicial Confirmation Committee, Representative Powell apologized and said, look, I don't want you to think I'm anti-gay. I've had an evolution in my thinking. I believe in the principles of lady justice, and I can treat people fairly.
And his apology was accepted by...
Accepted by some, yeah. Not by everyone. He got blasted pretty good by a couple of community advocates. But Troy Williams, who's the executive director of Equality Utah, said, look, we have worked alongside each other the last couple of years to advance legislation that it enhances the equality of all citizens, and I'm going to take you at your word. I'm going to accept your apology. I'm going to honor the journey that you say that you've been on around these issues. But I don't think that means anybody's going to not be watching.
Okay.
So he was confirmed without any opposition by the full Senate on Wednesday.
Okay. Well, guys, we packed the show and we couldn't get everything that we wanted to. You can find all of this reporting, including Jennifer Doudna's report on that confirmation at sltrib.com. But it is time right now for the underplayed stories of the week. And who's ready with an underplayed story? Anybody?
Jennifer. I don't know if it's underplayed. It appeared in today's paper. It is a story by my colleague Peggy Fletcher Stack about a video that Black student at BYU has done about the experience of being Black on campus. It's really fascinating. It's something that this young woman did on her own, and I think it's worth a read.
Check it out at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke.
I'll jump in. Peggy also did a blog post this week about the church retiring its Little Factories pamphlet, which is, you got to check that out. That's a fun one. But I would say, this is sort of a nice how-to. Matt Canham did a story about how to deal with your family at Thanksgiving this year, given the fraught political environment there. I use that word again. Sort of the tension that you might experience on Thanksgiving. So check that out.
Check it out at sltrib.com. Kyle Goon, have you got one?
Yeah, I was just going to cite my colleague Matthew Piper, who did an interview with an attorney who is in a film called The Uncondemned, which is opening at the Broadway this week. And it's about he was the first person, I believe, to successfully prosecute rape as a war crime. And when you think about just atmospheres and attitudes, and it might be an important story for people to think about.
Okay, and appearing at the Broadway Center Cinema there. Thanks, Kyle Goon, for that report. How about Brian Maffley, your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, well, buried in some of Paul Raleigh's columns in the last few days are these very troubling incidents of kind of racist, inflammatory, threatening postings at various schools in Utah following the election of President Trump, Donald Trump.
Yeah. Okay, you can check that out as well at sltrib.com. On my end, I'll go with something that's been popping up a lot in recent days, and that's how do you say this word?
Proliferation.
Thank you. Proliferation of fake news websites that have found their niche in circulation on social media. There was no one story about this, but NPR had a piece, The Washington Post. And then Facebook and Google are saying that they are going to try and address this problem. But I just want to make a plug for legacy reporting outlets and trained journalists, people who are working with a public purpose and not necessarily trying to get the most clicks. Among them, all of the people who joined me this hour on the program, and that is Thomas Burr, Jennifer Doudna, Robert Gerke, Kyle Goon, and Brian Maffley, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Actually, and another piece is Thomas Burr, as president of the National Press Club, signed a letter to the Trump administration asking him to allow or to keep the press pool sort of intact and allow the press pool to go with him. And that's worth checking out. I don't know if the Tribune has it at its website or not. Robert Gierke, any thoughts?
I'm not sure I've seen it, but I you can probably find it.
You can just Google it.
Yeah. Thank you, Roger. And CNN just posted an item about how to beat the fake news items that appear on Facebook, by the way. I just read it just now. It's interesting.
We'll check it out. Okay. Well, again, Jennifer Doudna, Robert Gierke, Thomas Burr, Kyle Goon, Brian Maffley, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
For the third week in a row, we've not saved enough time on the show for our Robert Kirby segment, but we will bring you more Kirby segments in the future. And you can, of course, check out the Kirby archives at sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio up in Logan, and to the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. You can find us on Facebook at KCPW-FM. At Twitter, we are at KCPW. You can follow me personally. I'm at Roger McDonough. A quick note that we're taking a break next week for the Thanksgiving holiday, but we will return the following Friday at the same time here on KCPW 88.3 and 105.5 FM in Salt Lake City and on Utah Public Radio around the state. Thanks again for joining us here on Behind the Headlines. Enjoy your weekend and next week's holiday as well.